From Washington, D.C., across the nation and around the world, stand by for an overview of the hottest topics and people being discussed on air, online, at the coffee shop, and across the backyard fence, powered by the research of Talkers Magazine, The National Conversation. It's time for the Michael Harrison Wrap. Here's Michael Harrison.
Thank you, Victoria Jones. Monday, September 13th through Friday, September 17th, 2021. It was a week of continued political turmoil as we enter the 21st year of the post-9/11 era. The dust settles in the aftermath of the Afghanistan fiasco. The California recall has come and gone. The immigration crisis continues, and the weather is a lot more than small talk. The Biden budget takes center stage. China remains a pain in the butt. And the COVID crisis continues to shred whatever it was that we consider to be a normal way of life. Stand by as we're about to embark upon a bold hour of Black Belt Talk Radio in which your tolerance for hearing different but legitimate points of view will be tested. We've got three colorful individuals this week waiting in the wings to tickle your brain with notions and emotions. Try not to get angry, just maintain an appropriate amount of educated skepticism. We'll hear from talk show hosts Eric Erickson of WSB Radio in Atlanta, Jimmy Failla of Fox News Radio's Fox Across America, and former Mayor Rudy Giuliani of WABC New York. Opinionated yappers from across the country with microphones, smartphones, and digital recording devices sharing their observations as well as the feelings of their target constituents with whom they often do their daily dance of affirmation in a fragmented, noisy world in which we try to avoid the modern-day syndrome of seeking victory at the expense of truth. Welcome to the Michael Harrison Wrap. Heard coast to coast and around the world on great radio stations in the U.S. and the U.K. A hyperverbal examination of the past week's hottest political and social topics discussed in the American talk media and played out in the theater of your mind. Information's gathered from a variety of sources, including data tracked by the broadcasting trade publication Talkers Magazine, of which I'm editor and publisher. Fasten your Sea Crane CC earbuds. Speaking of which, this installment of the Michael Harrison Wrap is being sponsored in part by the good folks at Sea Crane, makers and distributors of fine radio and radio-oriented equipment. Visit their website at seacrane.com or give them a call at 800-522-8863. Okay, here we go. Joining us now is Kevin Casey, executive editor of Talkers Magazine. Kevin, give us a rundown of the 10 most talked about stories on talk shows in America this past week.
Thank you, Michael. At number 10 this week, the SpaceX tourist launch. America's fascination with the private exploration of space continues.
A SpaceX rocket launched into orbit Wednesday evening, carried four people, none of whom are professional astronauts, and kicked off the first ever mission to Earth's orbit in which the crew was composed entirely of tourists.
At number 9, U.S.-China relations. A new U.S. security alliance with Australia and Great Britain regarding the building of submarines to reinforce America's might in the Pacific has reportedly infuriated China.
But the pact also incensed France, America's oldest ally. France feels its interests in the region have been betrayed by the submarine-centered agreement.
At number 8, the Larry Nassar hearings. A Senate Judiciary Committee hearing on Wednesday gave several acclaimed gymnasts who were abused by Larry Nassar a powerful platform to call out the system that failed them.
They included Simone Biles, Michaela Maroney, Maggie Nichols, and Ali Raisman. The women claimed the FBI botched its investigation into allegations against Nassar and the intimidation that came from the sport's governing bodies. Raisman described the incompetence as serving innocent children up to a pedophile on a silver platter.
At number 7, a four-way tie between climate change, immigration, race relations, and abortion. These topics have proven to be mainstays of the national conversation as expressed in the American talk media.
On the immigration front, as pointed out on this program for weeks, a new study found that mainstream news networks have largely avoided the continuing crisis on the U.S.-Mexico border, despite new footage revealing the crisis is not losing intensity.
At number 6, a four-way tie between the economy, the budget, the infrastructure, and inflation. House Democrats on Wednesday completed the daunting task of translating President Biden's economic vision into a $3.5 trillion tax and spending proposal, marking a major milestone in a fight that's still far from over.
The plan faces even more significant hurdles in the Senate, prompting Biden to embark on a renewed effort Wednesday to try to reassure wavering members of his own party, including centrists West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin and Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema.
At number five, Afghanistan. As the dust begins to settle in the aftermath of the U.S. withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan, Republicans are calling Biden's handling of the exit an epic military and foreign policy disaster, including some who previously supported the decision to end the war.
And on the Democratic side, support for the president hasn't quite been across the board. New Jersey Senator Bob Menendez, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, stated, "The execution of the U.S. withdrawal was clearly and totally flawed."
At number four, the new Woodward book and its depiction of General Milley's actions. A new book by Bob Woodward and Robert Costa titled Peril has revealed damning insights into President Trump's handling of events leading up to and following the January 6 riot at the Capitol,
including highly controversial actions by Joint Chiefs Chairman General Mark Milley, who's reported to have single-handedly made secret moves to limit Trump from potentially ordering a dangerous military strike or launching nuclear weapons.
At number three, the January 6 Commission and the September 18 demonstration. The committee to investigate the attack on the Capitol has increased the heat on former President Trump, demanding a minute-to-minute accounting of his actions leading up to and during the riot of January 6.
At the time we're putting this program to bed on Friday morning, no one is quite sure how the planned demonstrations in Washington this weekend supporting those arrested for their role in the January 6 event as political prisoners will play out.
At number two this week, the California recall. The suspense is over. Governor Gavin Newsom won a resounding victory over the movement to recall him by a 2-1 margin.
But conservative talk show host Larry Elder has significantly raised his profile for the effort and is now considered a force within the California GOP.
And at number one this week, COVID-19 boosters, vaccines, masks, and mandates. The political discord over mask and vaccine mandates continues to create anxiety and strife in the nation's effort to gain an upper hand in the battle against the coronavirus and its highly contagious Delta variant.
The efficacy of boosters has taken center stage in the fight that just painfully grinds on and continues to sow chaos within our tortured society. Thank you, Kevin Casey from Talkers Magazine. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. Let's head to WSB Atlanta and a visit with the talk show host who's been tremendously successful in the 12 noon to 3 p.m. slot formerly filled by the late Rush Limbaugh on the Southern Heritage Giant. His name is Eric Erickson. Eric, so much is happening this week. I'm curious as to how you're handling the controversy about COVID-19 boosters and vaccines. So many people think that every conservative talk show host in America is telling his or her listeners not to get vaccinated. And as far as I can see, that's hardly the truth.
You know, I talk about it real world. I've got a 12-year-old, a 16-year-old, now 16, just turned 16, my wife and I. We've all been vaccinated. My wife has a bad form of lung cancer, stage four. The kids, my wife had gotten vaccinated. The kids wound up getting COVID, and my wife never got it. Thankfully, it would have been fatal to her. And she, so I explained to people that, and my wife actually gets her booster tomorrow. And I'm not trying to force people to get it. I'm trying to answer questions, but I'm trying to explain to it. I'm not scared of it. And there is a lot of hesitancy. There is a lot of disinformation. There is a lot of American gumption there of when you tell me to do something, dig your heels in and say, no, I'm not. And I'm just trying to be as relational and transparent about my life with my audience. And I do think it works. I get a lot of emails from a lot of listeners and phone calls, and I try to engage every single one of them. To my wife's chagrin, to some degree, she says I spend too much time with my listeners and not enough time with the family right now. But she does also get the importance of I'm just trying to help people make a decision and steer them to their doctor, because I'm not one.
One of the problems is a lot of people, because of the high-profile tragic deaths of our friends and colleagues such as Phil Valentine and Mark Bernier and several other conservative hosts who had referred to themselves as anti-vaxxers, there seems to be this feeling that all of conservative news talk radio is anti-vax and trying to have people, you know, avoid that.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. You know, this it reminds me in a completely different scenario, but back in the 93 or whenever it was, 94, the Oklahoma City bombing, and the Democrats came after Rush Limbaugh and talk radio and tried to condemn it and say it's It's fueling this. Mm-hmm. We see this time and time again. People on the left who have always demonized talk radio just yet again find another reason to demonize talk radio. And yes, there were some voices in talk radio that were skeptical or anti-vaccine, but I don't think that's the majority of people in talk radio. It's just people would rather deal with the caricature than the reality. Mm-hmm. And the reality is most every person in talk radio I know has been supportive of talking to your doctor and having people on to tell you, talk to your doctor, make up your mind. None of us want to tell you what to do or think for you.
Looking across the country from the East Coast, obviously you probably had great interest in the California recall. And as it turned out, Gavin Newsom was not recalled. And talk show host Larry Elder had his moment in the sun. And as to what he's about to do at the moment we're having this conversation, I'm not quite sure. I suspect he'll go back to being on the radio. What's your view of that whole thing?
You know, it was great for Larry Elder, the exposure he got. But unfortunately, I think the exposure allowed Gavin Newsom to make this about Larry Elder. And a conservative talk radio show host is simply not going to get elected in California. The demographics are not there. It's 2-1 Democrat. The moment the race became about Larry Elder, you actually saw the polling that was about 50-50 in favor of the recall or against it, tied. It started to plunge. And look, again, no disrespect intended at all, but Larry Elder being a conservative, not having nothing to do with his race, as the Democrats unfortunately tried to make it somehow targeting him because of his race and being a conservative. The fact is he was a conservative regularly on Fox News. Every time he went on Fox News, the Newsom team made sure his supporters knew that Elder was bypassing California media, going to Trump supporters on Fox News. And it made it very easy for Newsom to say this is a attempted Republican takeover, and he never actually had to deal with the hypocrisy in his record. That was the whole purpose of the recall. He, I think, probably could have been recalled had those against him steered their message better. If you don't define the message and make it about Newsom, the message will be about you, and the Republicans fell into that.
Mm. So what you're saying is the Republicans might have been better off if it wasn't Larry Elder, but somebody that was less of a target for Trump-fearing Californians.
Yeah, I think so. I'm not a Kevin Falconer fan, for example, but Falconer galvanized support for the recall, was able to help get the recall, and stayed in the background. And to his detriment, Larry Elder is a popular conservative radio show. I like Larry Elder. I like listening to him. He's got a very high name ID among conservatives, and that high name ID let him vault to the lead, which was still only 17-18%. But when you've got 2 billion people running in the California recall, that becomes enough to win the recall. And it allowed Gavin Newsom someone he could point to and say it's about him. And Elder being a talk radio show host, he was perfectly happy to talk and talk in response, as opposed to trying to pivot every single time back to it's not about me, it's about Newsom's record. And the messaging discipline there probably should have been different.
Well, there's always a lot of conversation going on about the January 6th commission, Eric, and we have this September 18th event coming up. Now, you and I are talking on Thursday, the 16th of September, just to timestamp it, so we don't really know how it's going to go over the weekend when this program is playing coast to coast. So what are your thoughts about the event of September 18th that's, at the time we're talking, still in the works?
You know, I actually didn't even know it was going to happen until, I guess, yesterday. That would have been Wednesday, a few days before it happened, that it was in the plans. I'd been oblivious to it with so much other stuff going on. I do think they probably should have thought differently, because the Democrats have been very open and transparent for a while now that they want to do everything possible to define Republicans by it and tie Republicans to it and remind everyone about January 6th. So it plays into the Democrats' hands with the press. You're not going to get probably a massive number of people there. I would be interested in the crowd size, but I suspect that the media will give a disproportionate coverage to the crowd size as a way to try to tar and feather all conservatives. When you have an event like that, it's very hard for the organizers to control the messaging and optical dynamics of it. When there are always people who want to come and disrupt and make it about themselves, and those are the people who will get the media attention. It's not going to be fair, but it's definitely going to be widespread. That being said, you're not going to have any elected Republicans there. To my knowledge, I read a press report this morning that only two known Republican candidates will be there. So it's going to be hard for the press, nonetheless, to try to tie that to Republican candidates next year. The Democrats at this point, they do see the midterm polling. They do understand the historic trend lines for the midterms. They've got to try to do something to mitigate the damage that's otherwise coming from redistricting and the like. So it appears they're going to ramp up the tie every Republican to January 6th and tie Republicans to the unvaccinated crowd and make Americans blame the unvaccinated for the economy not recovering. That's at least going to be their attempt. It's at least a coherent strategy. I just don't think it's going to work.
That's Eric Erickson, who hosts the daily noon to 3 p.m. program on WSB in Atlanta, as well as other stations across America via national syndication. Coming up next, a conversation with one of the funniest radio talk show hosts in America. You're plugged in to the Michael Harrison Wrap. Hey, fellow radio lover, thank goodness for C. Crane. C. Crane specializes in high-quality radios and radio-oriented audio products. Last week, I told you about C. Crane CC Solar Observer. This week, it's C. Crane CC Pocket Radio, one of the most popular pocket radios on the market today. Unbeatable AM-FM reception with crisp, clear audio for its small size. You can listen using the included CC earbuds, tuned for voice quality, or with the built-in speaker. The CC Pocket Radio has five memory buttons. Instantly select your favorite station. It's also a great emergency radio because it has a lighted dial and the NOAA weather band with alert. Lightweight and durable, it's very easy to hold with rubber sides and a pocket clip. The CC Pocket Radio is ready to go anywhere. To order the CC Pocket Radio, call C. Crane now at 800-522-8863. That's 800-522-8863 or visit ccrane.com. Continuing now with the Michael Harrison Wrap. Jimmy Failla is one of the funniest news talk radio hosts on the air in America today. He joined Fox News Radio as the host of its midday syndicated show, Fox Across America, right before the pandemic hit, and he's been receiving rave reviews ever since. He spent years driving a cab in New York City and has a great track record as a stand-up comic. He brings a provocative combination of conservative politics and satire to the airwaves every day. The following conversation is excerpted from a longer discussion I recorded with Jimmy several days ago for this week's installment of my podcast, The Michael Harrison Interview. Here's a sneak preview. Based on what you just said with your age, you were in your early to mid-20s when 9/11 happened. We just experienced 9/11. You were already an adult, and now you are a double adult. It's sort of like twice as much time has gone by in your life since then. How'd you handle that?
Well, I will tell you, back then, all my brothers are city cops. It's funny, everybody in my family is a cop except me. Like, I would have been a cop if it weren't for this thing called the background check. But, you know, getting past that, everybody was a cop, and my brothers worked that day. They were off duty. My brother Joey got called in first, so I had to drive him in. They had checkpoints because they had parts of the Grand Central shut down, like getting closer to where it merged with the LIE. So I had driven him to a rallying point in Queens, and then he went on to the city. So he probably got there about an hour after the first tower fell, and, you know, it was crazy at the time. I mean, what I would tell you, and as someone who tries to offer people, you know, some type of positive takeaway, is that the thing that was just so stunning is that, you know, not just the resiliency, but the national unity that was shown in the immediate aftermath was something I always think of. In that, you know, as a driver in New York City, there was about a 3-week window where everyone had an American flag on their antenna. You know, I had seen this one guy put on his blinker before he changed lanes, which I had never seen before. I mean, if you're a New York driver, everybody knows the blinker. The middle finger is the blinker, for all intents and purposes. But there was a 3-week window where people were actually, you know, there. Everybody was there for each other. Everybody was on the same team. You know, no one ran into the Twin Towers asking who you voted for. You know, it was just, you know, humanity hanging in the balance, and everybody wanted to help everybody out. I don't feel that way when I watched the coronavirus. you know, which is also common cause. It attacks you indiscriminately of who you voted for. Yet we do seem a lot more interested as a country in fighting each other as opposed to fighting the pandemic. But the one thing I just wanted to throw in this five-hour answer I'm giving you is that in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, I had just started doing stand-up comedy. And this might blow everyone's mind listening, but every single comic in New York City was doing 9/11 jokes. Every single one. Because the people coming out to the clubs, it was, you know, cathartic. They were trying to bond, because that is the superpower of comedy for a lot of people, is that it's a coping mechanism. And if you can laugh at a tragedy, if you can laugh at an adversity, you kind of take the torment away from it, you know, for a minute at a time. And you'd be stunned. Like the Comedy Cellar down on McDougal Street, which is literally blocks from Ground Zero, it took, you know, maybe a week to reopen, but then it was packed every night. And, I mean, nothing anyone was doing on stage then could be done now, you know. But again, comedy didn't change. You know, we did. And it's crazy now, because if you probably – you told a 9/11 joke now, you could get fired. Yet you could have told one a week after, and no one cared.
I'm amazed when I look back at old videos on YouTube of old TV shows, Johnny Carson, comedy shows, how looser and less suppressed by political correctness things were than they are today. It's shocking. We seem to be in a much tighter time than, you know, I'm used to things getting more loose as time goes on, but that doesn't seem
funny,
to be the
when
case.
When you do a gig now, when you say you're doing a corporate gig or you're doing a college gig, the list of things they don't want you to address is usually 20 minutes longer than your act.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, yeah. It's pretty well known to the people listening to this conversation what I'm talking about in terms of the impact of political correctness on comedy in general, on anything, on any kind of conversation in general. How are you approaching the COVID pandemic, and how are you handling political correctness in general as a comedy-oriented news talk radio host?
The big thing I'm doing off the tippy top is I'm reminding everybody that it's our health, and I'm disgusted by the fact that we've gotten to a place where we're almost rooting against each other. You know, there are a lot of people in blue states rooting against what's going on in Florida and Texas, because then they can say, see, I told you so. You know, and there are a lot of people in red states that are, you know, shouting at anyone who gets the vaccine is like, look, they just want to control us. And I think there's a lot more nuance to these debates than anyone's allowing for. So what I'm trying to do, in all honesty, is lower the temperature and have a fact-based discussion of what it is. But I've been upfront with people. I'm vaccinated. My wife is vaccinated. My kid is vaccinated. And I tell them, like, my position is I do want it to be your choice as it pertains to whether or not you get vaccinated. I don't like the idea of a government telling us what we have to put in our bodies. But I also want to make sure that I'm drawing a distinction between taking that position and being anti-vax, because I'm not anti-vax. I'd be lying if I said I was. I got the Johnson & Johnson. What I didn't know is it was Magic Johnson and Keyshawn Johnson.
Oh, that's terrible.
I can't catch COVID, but man, can I catch a pass. You got to see my hands, Michael.
Oh, gosh.
Outrageous.
And what about Afghanistan? How have you handled that?
This one has been a hot one, man. You know, the last couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm trying again to make sure when I do my show, this is something Rush did pretty well, too. There's three ways you can do the show. You do it as a political analysis. You can do it as an entertainer. And you can do it as a sports fan. And when it comes to Afghanistan, I'm not a military expert, so I'm oftentimes doing it as a sports fan. And what I say is, you know, I'm going to cover this from a standpoint of who's winning, who's losing, and why, okay? And I generally take one of those three tactics when I'm approaching each one of these subjects, sometimes, you know, multiple at the same time. But when it comes to Afghanistan, I've just tried to, again, draw that distinction between we're not arguing over whether or not we should have left, because that was something agreed to by the previous administration. We're very much arguing over how we left. But again, I'd like to say we shouldn't be concerned in this moment with the political cost of what's going on. You know, even if you're on the right and you're going, oh, this is polling terrible for Biden, this is going to kill him in the midterms, that's no consolation for me, because there's people that are adversely affected by what's going on in real time. It's no different than the border. Like, I don't care about the politics because it's a now problem. You know, when your house goes on fire, you don't want to call the fire department and hear, well, you're in luck because there's an election in 2 years and we're going to get people in here that love fighting fires. All you want is the truck with the water in the hoses. So I'm trying to give them solutions in every one of these aspects.
I think I saw a tweet by you It's one of those things in the periphery where the joke was something to the effect, I'm going to botch it up, but I want to get to the point of it rather than tell a joke. You said something about that Joe Biden would make a great greeter at Costco if you don't mind being told welcome to Walmart or something, or Target. Did you tweet that or did I?
Yeah. Just some silly Sunday night chicanery. I said, at his age, Joe Biden would make a phenomenal Walmart greeter if you don't mind being welcome to Target.
Did you write that joke? Was that your joke or were you passing it on again?
Yeah.
But why are you going, yeah, I'm not knocking it. I'm not.
I know. It was a throwaway. Because
I'm getting
really
to a point. But respond now and then I just want to get to my point. But go ahead.
Oh, okay. No, get to your point first.
My point is Joe Biden a good target for comedy or was Trump a better target? That's basically it. I was not judging the appropriateness of your comment. I thought it was funny. I laughed.
Oh thanks. All I was going to say to the point is yes. I think that Trump was the worst target for political comedy ever. As much as people say, oh, you get so much material, that was the problem, is that topical jokes, when it came to, if you were a political comedian back in the day, so you're Mort Saul, there used to be a shelf life to topical humor. You know, George Bush couldn't pronounce the word nuclear. You know, Bill Clinton shacked up with an intern. You could write jokes about those two things for 5 years. And people would still consume them as if they were new and fresh because it was not something everybody did. The problem with Trump is he was creating so much content that, let's say you wrote a joke about him tweeting Covfefe or whatever that term was.
Right.
You know, if you were telling that a year later, you look like the guy who got out of prison and didn't know the fashion trends changed. You were walking around in fish tank pumps, and everybody's like, yeah, the pimps don't wear that anymore out on 42nd Street. You look weird. And I think that was the biggest challenge of Trump, and also because, whether intentional or not, a lot of the things Trump does are funny, because they might be quirky or unconventional. He'd have moments that were purely funny. He'd also have moments that were just terrifying, but I found that the biggest challenge was actually keeping up with it. You know, Biden in general doesn't generate that much content because he's not tweeting all day. He's not doing, as many press events as Trump is. And I feel like if you wanted to, be a guy who was just solely doing political comedy, this administration is probably the best one ever because it doesn't move at the pace of the last one.
I think the moving of the pace that you're talking about is something that's affecting everybody and everybody's life. I mean, in some ways, we're all prisoners just getting out, not knowing what the fashion is. And it's happening so quickly that, yeah. I often say I feel like a person in one of those old movies at the end of the movie when the train is pulling out and the two people are separated, perhaps they're lovers in a romantic 40s movie, and the man is running along and they're holding he's touching his hand to the window of the train and the train's pulling out and he's running and running. And I sometimes feel like I'm chasing the train and I'm running out of platform in terms of the technology.
It's all the cartoon version of that now. You're running and running and then you slam into a pole that
right.
You didn't see coming.
Exactly. I think we're all in that boat, and I think that's more than people in the media. I think that's people in everyday life. In conclusion, do you think we're living in a time of heightened anxiety, or do we just feel that way because it's the now, and that it's always been a time of anxiety being a human being? What are your thoughts about those deep philosophical questions?
This is what I think. I think when it comes to accelerate, I think social media has accelerated our anxieties. Because we're so connected now in a way we never were. You know, people like to say, oh, Americans can't coexist anymore. But it's not that we can't coexist. It's that we're being asked to coexist too much. You know, there was a time, every time throughout history where we had political disagreements over a lot of the same social issues we're fighting over now. The difference being is that, that guy you disagreed with, you'd go home from work and not see him till tomorrow, or that relative you disagreed with, you wouldn't see him till a month from now when we had the next aunt's birthday party. Now the people you disagree with are in your pocket 24 hours a day, and compounding that is we're living in a time of incentivized conflict. Twitter is rewarding its consumers with the highest amounts of digital dopamine, I guess is that what I would call likes, you know, for portraying their ideological others in the worst terms possible. You know, if you get on Twitter and write a silly joke, you'll get a response. But if you get on Twitter and call every Republican in the country a white supremacist, that response will be triple from the people who agree with you. Just the same as if you're a conservative and you get on and say these commies hate the country and they want to destroy it from within. As long as you remember to put an exclamation point on that, you got a free 200-300 likes and retweets. And some people have gotten so addicted to that dopamine that they're kind of operating independent of, you know, any self-awareness to realize that what they're doing is not only helping their cause, it's not helping their cause, and in fact, it's hurting the country because we can't have civil discourse. So I think the truth is, like, we are living at a time of heightened anxiety, accelerated by social media, and that's why the thing I'm really trying to be responsible with, as someone who listened to so much talk radio, I mean, 10 years in a taxi, it's a lot, man. And, you know, people used to say at the beginning when I first started driving, you know, do you have a profile? Do you not pick people up, you know, because they look dangerous? And it's actually not true. If you're driving a cab for 10 years, you want to die. Okay, I didn't pick you up in my cab, it's because you didn't look dangerous enough. I mean, in truth, but as a guy who consumed so much radio, you know, I realized we have a responsibility in the sense that the vibe we distill is something not only taken home by our listener, but it's something that they're ultimately going to distill to their friends and family and coworkers. So what I say to people is try to be a force multiplier of just cool. And I don't mean cool like the Fonz, like you got a pack of cigarettes under your arm. I just mean cool, like easy to be around, you know, someone who can consume this information without needing to fight, without needing to win, without needing to agitate. And that's why I say in this moment, you know, we don't need more Republicans. We don't need more Democrats. We just need less assholes. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that, but I guess I should have cleared it before we came on the air.
I'll check with legal.
There he is.
That's Jimmy Failla, the nationally syndicated host of Fox Across America, with an excerpt from an in-depth conversation I had with him from my podcast, The Michael Harrison Interview, scheduled for release next week. At the start of today's show, we counted down the 10 most talked about topics of the week according to talkers. Now let's take a moment before the break, during the next minute, and run through the 10 most talked about people according to talkers.com. At number 10, we have Larry Nassar. Number 9, Mitch McConnell. Number 8, Nancy Pelosi. Number 7, Greg Abbott. Number 6, Ron DeSantis. Number 5, Mark Milley. Number 4, Donald Trump. Number 3, a tie between Gavin Newsom and Larry Elder. Number 2, Dr. Tony Fauci. And number 1, Joe Biden. For all sorts of behind-the-scenes talk media industry information, visit talkers.com. Coming up next, another podcast excerpt in which I caught up with Rudy Giuliani right after last weekend's memorial tribute commemorating the 20th anniversary of 9/11. You're plugged in to the Michael Harrison Wrap.
This report is brought to you by Genesis 2 Project, G2P. Recently, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, the ODNI, released a preliminary report on possible threats posed by UFOs, now known as Unidentified Aerial Phenomena, UAP, and the progress the Department of Defense UAP Task Force has made in understanding any threats. Dr. J.C. Van Valkenburg is a former Los Alamos National Lab biophysicist who has been working with G2P to bring scientifically sound UAP data to the public.
G2P has released the first scientifically authenticated documentation of UAPs, including images captured with infrared technology. Primo Forensics performed the digital forensic analysis.
In tandem with the ODNI report, these data support the development of relevant processes, policies, technologies, and training for the U.S. military and government personnel upon encountering UAP. Visit Genesis2Project.com.
Continuing now with the Michael Harrison Wrap as we discuss the hottest topics of the past week in the national conversation. This past Monday, right after the weekend in which America paid tribute to the victims' families and first responders of 9/11, memorializing the 20th anniversary of the tragic event, I caught up with my buddies at WABC New York, where they had done a full weekend of special programming about the historic milestone. I spoke with station CEO John Catsimatidis, station president Chad Lopez, and station talk show host and former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani. The full conversation is now available in my weekly podcast, The Michael Harrison Interview, at mhinterview.com. But right now I'm going to play for you excerpts from that conversation focusing on Rudy Giuliani. And I've always looked at the job of mayor of New York as being the closest one could come to being a figure in a small town that's almost as big as being president of the United States. It's in this very unique position. And the great mayors going all the way back to LaGuardia and Jimmy Walker. I remember James Cagney playing that part, I believe. I mean, that, you know, that you're sort of the morning man. It's like being a radio host of the city just by the job. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
How did you feel? How'd you find that to be?
Well, you hit it right, nail right on the head. I knew, I mean, I'm a student of New York history. I read everything about it, and including Moses' gigantic opus forever, right, mm-hmm. on the city. The people who succeed as mayor of the city of New York are bigger than life.
Yeah.
So if you're not, you'd better make yourself bigger than life. And you've got to be all over the place, and you have to be willing to answer questions. So 5 months into being mayor, Newsday did a front page cover. I thought they thought it was critical. I loved it. It had me on the front cover with a microphone in front of my face, earphones on, and they said, "Air Giuliani." And the idea of the piece was I was trying to go around them by being on the air all the time, being on radio, being on television. Well, they were absolutely right. I wanted to go around them because I could deliver my message directly to people without their distorting it, changing it, making it fix their ideology. You know, I wanted people to work for welfare. I knew immediately when I said that they're going to paint it as mean Giuliani wants people to work. I wanted it to be, I want you to work the way I want my kid to work because I love you. Because if I don't leave you with a work ethic, I just left you destroyed.
Wow.
So, yeah, I mean, they don't love you. They don't really give a damn about you. You're just a number and a vote. To me, you're like my son. If I can come out of this job having putting hundreds of thousands of you to work, I will feel like I'm a very successful man. If I have the same damn ridiculous unemployment rates that Dinkins gave me, I'm a failure.
Yeah. Well, they're going to study history for years and years and years over the nuances of politics and the execution thereof in terms of the juxtaposition of Dinkins' administration into your administration. And it was a tremendous transition. I wish I had hours to talk to you. Maybe someday we'll have a longer conversation about that because it's important stuff. Rudy, you're out there in the marketplace of ideas. Big time. I mean, this has been a hell of a year for you. How do you handle the fact that no matter what you think the truth is, there are a significant number of people out there who will not believe you just because of whatever your label is or where you fit within their scheme of things?
Well, I've dealt with that, you know, for a long time since I started representing Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Up until then, I was a Republican. I was actually a moderate Republican and probably lost the Republican nomination in an 08 because I was too socially liberal a Republican, like an outsider. But I have always been a very conservative Republican about foreign policy. And I've always been a very conservative Republican about economic policy. So I get the more the issues become, for example, what Biden did in Afghanistan, the stronger a Republican I am. The more the issues become, he wants to spend now $3.5 trillion on top of already increasing our budget by 28%. Nobody increases budgets by 28%. He's ruining our economy. So those are the issues that get me then very, very Republican. But then attaching myself to Donald Trump, I attach myself to the man for whom there is a sickness in this country among certain people. They have Trump derangement syndrome. I mean, they really do. They've gone, whatever you think of Donald Trump, good, bad, in between, he is not the devil. He's not, but they have built up in their head. And when you look at the condition of the country, just think of this. Look at the condition of the country today under nice Joe Biden and the condition of the country 2 years ago under mean Donald Trump. So,
well, I'm not going to go down that rabbit hole.
Well, I'm going to tell you.
That is a rabbit hole.
I'm going to tell you. That's the reason why people hate me and love me.
Mm-hmm.
When I meet people on the street, they come up and they say, I love you. I love the way you supported the president. I love what you stick up for, what you believe. And the other ones come up to me and say, how did you change? And I try to explain to them, I haven't changed.
Mm.
This is my view of the truth.
Right,
Everything I have said, I can back up by documents, witnesses. They just don't want to hear it. So,
all right. Well,
I've always based what I do on a test my father taught me. I wake up in the morning. When I come time to shave, I take a little pause and I say to myself, am I doing the right thing about the controversy? And sometimes I'm not. And if I'm not, I change. I call my friend and I apologize. And when I believe I'm doing the right thing, I don't care if it's the New York Times or I was a lot more right about the New York Times, about New York City, than they were. If I did what the New York Times wanted me to do for New York City, I've got all the editorials to prove it, the city right now would probably be finished. Wouldn't even exist. We'd be so overwhelmed by welfare, and we'd make sure.
Well, that bounces back to what I said earlier about the juxtaposition of the Dinkins administration and the Giuliani administration. And it's interesting you say certain things make you more of a conservative Republican, other things moderate Republican, whether it's foreign affairs or the economy. Clearly, you're a major historic figure when it comes to the science, the art, the political science. Criminology of dealing with crime in an urban area. And a case could be made that you're an example of why a city the size of New York, the unwieldiness of New York, the transient nature of New York, the nooks and crannies, the infrastructure, the dark alleys, the complexity of New York, which is ripe for chaos if not run in an orderly way. You're a great case for why traditional, conservative, tough on crime administration is necessary. Whereas in a smaller city, a different place in the country, a different situation, it could come across as heavy-handed. So I'm not asking it as a question. It's more of a comment. Your reaction to that?
Yeah, you know, it isn't exactly that. Crime in New York City has to be dealt with. You don't have to deal with it any more harshly than in a small town. It's probably dealt with a lot more harshly in a small town than in New York City. I mean, in a small town, you have a little marijuana, you go to jail for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
In New York City, we don't pay attention to marijuana. The reality is New York City had to have a business approach, a scientific approach to crime. And that's what Bratton and I and Safer and Carrick brought to it, the CompStat system. We evaluate things based on statistics, not guesses, not politics. We try to find out the best facts we can about where is the crime being committed, who do we have to have there. That scientific approach to crime is what brought it down. And that's what made us prepared for 9/11. We spent 7.5 years preparing for 9/11. We didn't know 9/11 was coming that way. We knew bin Laden was going to attack us from 2.5 years. We were preparing for that guy attacking us. We thought he would attack our stores. We thought he would attack our churches. We didn't think he'd use airplanes as missiles. But because we prepared so much, we were just a lot more ready for it than any other place.
Mm.
And our heroes performed. Oh, my goodness. I mean, I don't know if there's ever been a more heroic operation in the history of the world.
Yeah. Politically, a lot of historians say that Michael Bloomberg probably never would have been mayor of New York had it not been for 9/11 and specifically your endorsement at the time. Any thoughts about that?
It's true.
Okay.
You always get straight answers from me. It's true. He would have lost by 15%. The Democrats are constantly screwing up. I mean, they've run the city into the ground. Chicago, 50 years of Democratic rule. 65 people shot, 10 dead this weekend. And then they just keep doing it. In New York, there's a different factor that goes on. Sometimes it gets so bad that the people of New York have an independence and they say, oh, we can't put up with it anymore. And then they'll pick a LaGuardia or a Lindsay or a me. And you asked about Mike. They pick Mike because September 11th knocked the living daylights out of them. And neither Democrat candidate looked like a leader. They weren't sure of Mike. And at that point, the reason I got him elected is only because I was at an artificial 90% approval rating at the time. So they, you know, he got my endorsement at the single best time you could ever get an endorsement from a politician.
Taking this one step further, and you've already answered the obvious question is people say a Republican has a tough time getting elected anything in New York City because it's predominantly Democratic. But you and Michael Bloomberg and in the past others have been elected, and it can be done. You did a show on WABC just the other day during this whole special with Curtis Sliwa, who's a very interesting character that we've all known, and you've known him all the way back, I'm sure.
John, he's worked with John for a long time.
Yeah, exactly. Through the involvement with another radio station in New York, so there's been a lot of interbreeding there. But the point is this. Do you think that Curtis has a chance of winning this?
Yes, that's what he has, a chance. I mean, we have to be real with people, right? It's an outside chance.
Uh-huh.
If the experts are not accurately measuring the depth of the anger about what has happened to their beautiful city, if it's greater than the experts think, he could pull it off. But right now, the polling doesn't show that.
Well,
the polling shows that Adams has a pretty good lead. Now, I think polls about 10 years ago stopped being really important. And what I tell Curtis to measure when he's out there, How angry? The angrier they are, the more he has a chance to win. Mm-hmm. Angry about the conditions of the city, crime, whatever.
So you agree he has a chance? I think that's a very Yeah, that's a very honest answer.
He has a chance, and it comes from things that maybe we haven't measured yet.
Do you have a nice relationship with him from the days when you were mayor and he was a rising vigilante? He's a rising star in the world of vigilantes.
John, we all knew Curtis.
Has your view of Donald Trump changed in the last few months?
How about in the last 31 years?
However you want to answer it.
No, he's the same Donald Trump. One of the things the media does all the time, because you see different aspects of people, is you say, oh, they change, and people think I've changed. I haven't changed. I do the things I do for exactly the same reasons that I put Fat Tony Salerno in jail, or Mike Milken, or Ed Koch's commissioners, about half of them. From the time I became an assistant U.S. attorney, I've just got a sense of injustice, and crooks get me angry. And I'm a lawyer. I'm a very, very dedicated lawyer. And I represented Donald Trump just the way I represented 50 other people. And when you get me representing you, we fight to the death. Legally, but we fight to the death. And one of the reasons I'm having the trouble I'm having is I was his most effective spokesman. And not any doubt about it. That's why they want me off. I mean, the moment Biden announced, the first thing he did, he sent a circular around to all his pals in the media and said, don't put Giuliani on. Can you imagine that? One person he didn't want on, me. Don't put him on. I have it framed. Boy, you guys are really afraid of me.
That's former New York City mayor and present-day talk show host at WABC in New York, Rudy Giuliani. This interview has been excerpted from a longer conversation I had with Rudy, along with WABC CEO John Catsimatidis and station president Chad Lopez, which you can hear in its entirety on my podcast, The Michael Harrison Interview, at mhinterview.com. And that about does it for this latest installment of the Michael Harrison Wrap, an overview of the national conversation looking back at this week of Monday, September 13th through Friday, September 17th, 2021. Looking ahead, I'm sure we'll have plenty to talk about next week, including the ever-lurking unknown factor, that unanticipated surprise story that can take the national conversation spinning off.
in a totally unexpected direction. We sure do live in interesting times. I can be reached via email at michael@talkers.com. My podcast, The Michael Harrison Interview, can be heard at mhinterview.com. And if you want to stay in touch with the inner workings of the talk media industry, please visit talkers.com. The Michael Harrison Wrap. Our producer is Matthew B. Harrison. Thank you for listening.
The Michael Harrison Wrap is a production of Good Phone Communications in conjunction with Talkers Magazine and Talk Media Network. Copyright 2021, all rights reserved.